From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's connection starts with a story from the shores of Sodus Bay, 40 miles east of Rochester on Lake Ontario. Just a few years ago, in 2017 and 2019, historic flooding devastated the Sodus Point community. Rising water levels not only swallowed up docks and marinas, but also threatened homes and businesses. Erosion has chipped away at the shoreline, and algal blooms fueled by farm runoff have turned once clear waters into a murky green. Crescent Beach, once a vibrant natural barrier, has been breached by storms, leaving it vulnerable to further damage. These challenges are not just environmental, of course, they're personal. They're personal for the residents who've lived here for generations and for the many who come to enjoy the bay's beauty each summer. But this isn't just a local issue. Sodus Bay is a microcosm of the environmental challenges facing shorelines and communities across the Great Lakes. To discuss the Save Our Sodus movement and why everyone, regardless of whether you live in Sodus, should care, please help me welcome my esteemed guests. First, we have Don Reiling, the board president of Save Our Sodus. Don has been instrumental in leading the organization's efforts to protect and preserve Sodus Bay. Thanks for joining us today, Don.
Oh, my pleasure, Jasmine. Thank you for having us.
Excited to chat with you. Joining us as well is Dr. April Lumen, an environmental educator and associate professor at the Warner Graduate School of Education at the University of Rochester. Dr. Lumen is deeply involved in environmental education, particularly through programs that engage local youth in hands-on learning experiences. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Lumen.
I'm so glad to be here.
I'm thrilled about the work you do and looking forward to hearing more about it.
Thanks.
And finally, we're joined by Kira Stevenson, a nature-based learning coach at School Number 12 in the Rochester City School District. Kira has successfully integrated a comprehensive nature-based learning program into the school, and that's just so cool. I'm excited to chat about all of the educational efforts that all of you are doing. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I know you're not a stranger to Connections, so glad to have you on the Environmental Connections side of things. Don, to start us off, can you help our listeners understand the current situation with the shorelines of Sodus Bay? Like, what are the most pressing environmental challenges facing the bay right now, and why is it so important to address these issues so urgently?
I think that the bay is in better condition today than it was 25 years ago. SOS started because there was so much pollution running into the bay. 90% of the water in the bay comes from the watershed around the edges, and of course, there's a lot of agriculture, and there was pollution running in, and so fish couldn't live below 25, I think, or 27 feet. And so SOS was formed by some great people in our community. They put in thousands of hours, raised millions of dollars over several years. And today the bay's in better condition, but we're facing some long-term, as you said, major issues that are facing the whole Great Lakes. One of them, for example, is invasive species. Mm-hmm. We've had almost 200 invasive species invade Lake Ontario since 1959, when the St. Lawrence Seaway opened up. It opened for bilge water to come in from the ocean and from all over the world. Mm. And we've got some serious problems on that side.
Wow. Okay. Well, aside from the problems, describe Sodus for us, for those of our listeners who haven't been there.
Well, I actually discovered something yesterday that just I've been smiling about. I love Nantucket. I love New England, mm-hmm. and have been to Nantucket several times. I found out yesterday that there's a little part of Sodus Bay called Maceyville, and a big chunk of Sodus Bay was developed by Sylvanus Macy of the Macy family, who bought Nantucket.
Wow.
And he came to our part of the country and thought it looked like home. Hmm. And so he created a community. He created all these different industries, and it made sense to me why I love it so much. It's a beautiful 5-mile-long bay, tremendous fishing It's a big sailing destination because when the lake's too dangerous to be on, you can always sail on the lake or sail in the bay. Mm-hmm. We have four beautiful islands, one that you can get to by bridge. All the rest of them you can only get to by boat. And Eagle Island, for example, has 60 cottages on it. And it's just generations, for generations, people have treasured this place.
You know, I've only lived in the area for a few years, and I'm just constantly amazed by how absolutely stunning it is. And there's just always something to find and to discover. Now, of course, you've been with Save Our SOTUS for some time now, and the organization has grown significantly over the past 25 years. Can you walk us through some of the key milestones in SOS's history, like some of the major turning points, how it shaped the organization's current focus?
Well, one of the first things that the group did was they began to do what's called StreamWatch, where they monitored, there are approximately five major tributaries that feed into the bay. So they started checking the kind of work that Kira and Dr. April do, where they were checking for insects, for water quality, for flow rates, oxygen levels. All of these things determine whether fish and even birds can live in the area. One of the exciting things that's happened in the last 10 years is we now have 12 pairs of nesting eagles.
Oh, wow.
So on any given day, I'll sit on the upstairs of my house and I'll look and an eagle will go over. And there's an osprey. There's now nesting ospreys as well. And it's like a shot of adrenaline every time I see them, right?
Magical.
It really is.
Wow. That is so cool.
So by working on water quality issues over the years, we're seeing a resurgence even of some fishing species that had been extinct. One of the really exciting stories in Lake Ontario was the introduction of the Pacific salmon. And people don't know that the salmon fish that are in Lake Ontario are the exact same DNA, the identical fish that are in the Pacific Northwest. And they brought them here because when they're first hatched, they live in freshwater. And then they move out into saltwater. So they thought, well, we needed a fish like the salmon to fight the zebra mussels. And because zebra mussels are invasive species for us. And so these salmon today, there are millions of them in the lake. They've become one of the biggest game fish. I caught one two summers ago. It was 25 pounds. I mean, that's a huge fish. And he gave me about a half hour fight. And then took him back to the yacht club and we fed about 20 friends,
wow.
You know. So it's all of these things we watch for these indicators of, is the lake healthy? And this is the kind of work that we're doing with SOS. Our three major arms of work are water quality, number one. Second one is shoreline retention because of the flooding 2017, 2019. People don't know that SOTUS Bay is the number one most vulnerable area on Lake Ontario. So of the whole shoreline, if a storm comes in because of our elevation and because the wind tends to blow out of the northwest. So, for example, with shoreline retention work, we have just obtained a grant from Senator Schumer for $20 million and to rebuild some of the breakwalls around the edge of the bay. And then the third is sustainable community. We've worked really closely with the businesses and neighborhood associations because it takes all of us. And that's where our working relationship with April and Kira has come in, because they're like the masters of getting kids excited and giving passion to the next generation and giving them tools. And with SOS, we need that.
Yeah.
We just recognize their amazing gifts.
Well, let's check in with our other guests. Dr. Lumen, you're deeply involved in environmental education, particularly with youth, as we mentioned. What do you see as the most significant environmental challenges facing the SOTUS area? And how are educational programs like the ones you run addressing these challenges?
I think the environmental challenges facing SOTUS, sadly, are many of the environmental challenges facing all of us in the world. And that's due to, you know, human-caused climate change, right? So I think the number one thing we need to help our youth understand is that this is serious, that that we need to pay attention and that they have amazing power to do something about it, right? We have to pair those two together, that some things are happening that we really need to pay attention to and use our science minds to try to understand, but that we can also really take action. So we always pair those together.
Well, let's talk more about your work with kids. Your work with Climate Action Camp for rural teens in SOTUS is fascinating. Can you talk us through what it takes to run a successful environmental education program? Because I want to be, you know, a fly on the wall. I'd love to know how these experiences prepare students to become future environmental leaders.
So the first thing we do, so a little bit of context, I teach future science teachers, future middle school and high school science teachers. Actually, Kira was one of my students back in 2004, a long time ago. Anyway, so preparing future science teachers, one of the things that I want them to learn first and foremost is that they need to be learners of the youth that they teach and the communities where the youth come from. And so SOTUS has been wonderful to partner with. And we start out our summer camp by thinking about what could we teach, what would be interesting, but then we check our understandings with a SOTUS stakeholder community. Don was part of that stakeholder community this year, which was awesome. So we pitched some ideas and they say, you should talk to Kim Buell. He's got a beehive. Or you should talk to Kristen Moore because she's got, does pretty much everything, actually.
Right.
But she could do sustainable fashion with you. So, like, we revise our ideas, and then we pitch them to the kids. And so we pitched sustainable fashion, pollinator party, and water Spartans, H2O Spartans this year. The kids get to choose which team, lab team, they want to join, and they spend the week with that. We begin with a nature-based, place-based experience out on the bay, on the beach, where they collect some data, maybe microplastics in the sand, and they analyze that. So they have this shared lived experience out in nature. Other key components are that our learning, as Kira's going to emphasize, is fully human, right? Learners are not just in their brains. We have hands and eyes and ears, and we need to be fully enacted in our spaces and our content, right? On our practices. So that's really important. And then we work toward a public showcase for the community again, where we engage in team. So teens engaged in action that matters. So, for example, one kids group studied the water around SOTUS Bay. And and as they were starting their first day of inquiry, the kids told them about this place where they drink out of the water near school. And they call it Jesus water because they thought it was better than Gatorade before sports events.
Wow.
That was a drainage ditch.
Oh, my goodness. Seriously?
Seriously, a drainage ditch. So my teacher said, okay, we're going to start looking at watersheds and farms and help kids understand where that water from the drainage ditch comes and what else is in there. And they did all the testing of the drainage ditch and developed a whole new appreciation for water quality. And before they left, then they made signs that said, this is our home. On Metz Pond, another pond, please take care of it. Don't trash our home. And they put signs up all around because they started to want to care about their water and they were proud of their water.
So let me ask you something. I love that story and I love how you're emboldening these children. How do you connect what they're doing with the complex and dire environmental issues that we're discussing today? Did they understand, like, the urgency, or is it more important? You're the educator here. Is it more important that they just get hands-on before maybe they're connecting those dots?
I think kids come with various levels of awareness. I think we meet them where they are and help them understand our citizenship on this earth and our relationship with land. We try to help them understand that land and water are their teachers and that we try to prioritize that relationship. And then if they're ready to hear more we have definitely prepared our pre-service teachers to go there. But again, always pairing despair with hope, right? Like it's important to make sure kids know that they can be agents of change.
So before the show, Dawn sent me some statistics that totally floored me. Is it true that 50% of the kids in the SOTUS school district have never seen Lake Ontario in person? And does that make the job of connecting these children to nature easier or harder?
Kira is going to talk a lot about that, I have no doubt. I think all of our youth are struggling with developing healthy relationships with nature because we have phones now, because we have other distractors, right? I was floored by that also, but I also work with youth in the city, and some of them have not been to Lake Ontario. Mm. So we've taken trips and done water quality on the shores of Charlotte Beach as well. I think it's just a really important calling for all adults to help kids be outside. They find pure joy in it when they're there. So I think we just need to nurture new ways of doing our days.
Love it. Absolutely. Let's turn to Kira. Kira Stevenson is a nature-based learning coach at school number 12 in the Rochester City School District. Kira, can you describe the specific methods that you use to connect with students, to connect them with nature at school number 12? Because I can tell that your colleagues here love you.
Absolutely.
It's true.
We do. Yeah.
I hope she shows you the coyote call.
All right, well, noted for later.
She's best. Yeah.
Oh boy.
I love it. How do the kids connect to nature?
Well, I think what's interesting that as I was listening to Don and April talk is both of them mentioned what I would consider this feeling of awe that one experiences if given the time and the place to be in nature and the power behind that awe. You know, awe can drive and enhance our passions for things. Awe can change behaviors to make change. Awe can rally a community. And, you know, awe can do a lot of work around healing ourselves and our relationship with ourselves or our relationship with this planet. And it's funny because when people ask, you know, like, how do you start a nature-based learning program? You know, I kind of joke that, well, you just open the door. Let's just start by going outside. But I'm not that naive in terms of that's not simple for everyone. And looking at where and who has the access to these places. And I'm not surprised at all by statistics. Actually, I was expecting that number to be even higher about the number of students or kids in SOTUS that haven't been to the Bay. Mm. Statistics, you know, it ranges a minute or two, but let's say on average, our kids now are spending 9 minutes a day outside. Mm. And if you really think about that, you know, what do you do for 9 minutes? Right? You get your breakfast ready, you make your lunch. That's the amount of time that kids are spending. And what does that time look like when they're outside? You know, is it walking from the front door to the car? Is it walking from the bus into the school and then out of the school to the bus? Is it walking around the block? Is it spending time on the beach? That kind of thing. And how that has an impact on our children, our families, our community, our ideas around solutions to climate change and how limiting that can be. So the way that we have found success at School 12 with nature-based learning is getting them to play and know their place and the importance and the value behind play and connecting with their place. It's measurable because there is data, and I can talk a little bit about data behind this because I think we've got enough data. It's now time for action and how to put it in practice, right? So the adults that are with these kids also have to be okay with getting kids outside. And I think really connecting on a micro and a macro level, you know, we have kids that are connected to the insects all the way up to the birds and the trees. And I love nature-based learning and those relationships because there's something for every child. And there's a positive impact that every child that I've worked with has experienced.
Well, let's talk about that. What tangible benefits in terms of academic performance or emotional well-being have you observed?
And I'm glad you brought that up because our three pillars for nature-based learning are academic growth, wellness, which goes with physical and mental wellness, and community building. And that includes community building with our natural species as well. Academic growth, you can start right away with curiosity and engagement. When we have looked at engagement levels of our students that have done nature-based learning at School 12, we've had 100% engagement. And I was a classroom teacher for many, many years. Thank you, April, for putting a date on that.
Sorry.
I was a classroom teacher for many, many years. And once you hit about like year 15, you're like, okay, I think I got this. I think I'm a pretty good teacher, you know, and you're always looking for ways for engagement because we know how important it is for engagement. And
how rare it is.
Yeah, right. And rarely do you get 100% engagement at the level that you would want, right?
Can I just ask, what is engagement?
So think about your energy and your focus on whatever the task may be, right? And I definitely have my own levels of engagement with certain things. You know, my husband's a bowling coach, and my level of engagement sometimes can be struggling because I don't have as much passion for bowling that he would, right? So appreciating that students, not every student walking into my classroom loved biology the way I loved biology, and so their engagement could vary. When we look at engagement with nature-based learning, it opens the door, not to be pun, but wider in terms of what students can and how they engage. So physically, how does their body feel with being outside as compared to sitting in a chair at a desk or sitting at a table or distractions of people around versus being able maybe to create some space? How our bodies take in information from our environment. So how does it feel to stand on grass that might be uneven versus, you know, in a building? How does the air feel? What other sounds are they exposed to? So just by being in a different location and our natural spaces, our bodies were designed to take in information from our natural spaces.
Love it. I mean, I think it's a really powerful idea that you're exposing children to nature and sort of letting nature be the teacher, it sounds like. And maybe that's oversimplifying it, but maybe it's not oversimplifying it. Do you feel like it helps children with issues of self-worth and things like that as well?
One of my favorite stories, and I try to tell different stories, but this one is still probably one of my favorites, was before I was even focused on nature-based learning specifically, but I was always very conscious of helping students create some sort of relationship with a natural being because in my mind, all natural beings have value like us. And so we had gotten tower gardens in our classroom and had done some work with the Seneca Park Zoo on putting in a pollinator garden. And of course, pollinator gardens, then the discussion goes to bees and bees sting. So, you know, you have kids that are like, I hate bees. And I had a student that was adamant at, you know, just really a bee stung me once and that's it. We are lifelong enemies. And through this project that they did in our courtyard, that mindset started to shift. And I want to say it was probably after like a spring break or a long weekend, this young man who struggled in school in general, from behavior to academics to engagement, you know, and all of the things, came in first thing in a morning and came right up to me and said, Mrs. Stevenson, you're never going to believe what happened. And that's, as a teacher, that's always a loaded statement from a student.
Right.
You never
like,
quite know what's going to come out.
Am I about to call the police?
Right. And he said, there was a bee in our house this weekend and my dad wanted to kill it. And instead, I explained why we needed to let the bee outside. And all of a sudden, this young man, this was a seventh grader, his body language completely changed. The shoulders went back, the chin went up, and he put his hands on his hips and he said, I'm a bee hero.
I love it.
Wow. And that hits so many. Like, there's academic growth in that. There's wellness.
There's radical empathy.
100%. 100%.
I mean, I think that's, like, kind of the core of what all teachers are ultimately going for, right? Mm-hmm. So nature-based learning can maybe do a whole lot more than just save our SOTUS. It could save a whole lot more than that. But speaking of Save Our SOTUS, let's turn back to you, Dawn. Save Our SOTUS has been involved in various large-scale projects to protect the bay, such as the East Breakwall and Crescent Beach Berm Repair. What have been the biggest challenges for you in terms of securing support for these projects? How do you work to overcome them?
You know, if I could go back just for a moment on what Kara was just talking about, one of the stories that motivated me, I teach leadership development as my career. And one of the stories that motivated me was I was in a leadership class for executives in a company here in Rochester. A young African-American man was sitting in the class, and he said to me, I own a home on the lake. I said, well, that's fantastic. He said, but you don't know where I came from. I said, okay. He said, I lived in the inner city. My father was in prison. My older brother was a drug addict. My other brother was killed by a homicide. He said, I would get on my bike with my group of friends at like 11 years old and ride all the way to Charlotte every day all summer. I said, wait a minute, that's how many miles was that? And it was a long way on little BMX bikes. I said, well, why is that important part of your story? He said, because being near the water changed my whole worldview. Mm. He said, I suddenly began to realize I was not trapped in the world I was stuck in. And I made a promise to myself that one day I would have a home near the water so my kids would grow up near the water, which is, you know, we're saying nature, right? It's the water is just this intense experience of nature. And I've encountered several stories like this. Yeah. And that's part of what's motivating this partnership and friendship with Kara and April is we want to get the kids out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not answering your question.
No,
yet, Jasmine.
I, you know what? I love that story. And it just reminded me that I mentioned I've only been here for a few years. I've only lived on either coast. I've lived in LA and New York City. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here, I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm worried that I won't be able to swim away if I need to. You know? Right. And then I saw the lake and I was like, why has this been so off my radar? Like, obviously I knew about it, but I don't think I understood the enormity of what is here in Western New York. And it's just the most peaceful, beautiful place on earth.
It really is. It's also 20% of the world's freshwater supply are the Great Lakes. And whereas most of the world is searching for fresh water, we sit on this amazing resource, but it's stunningly beautiful. And so the work we're doing, coming back to your question, is we're very aware that we've got to address water quality and shoreline retention and community development. But we're also aware if we don't get the next generation of kids involved, we're making a terrible mistake. We need to, like, give them this gift of infectious passion for the water.
Well said.
And so I watched April's camp this year, and I worked with some of her pre-service teachers, and they called me on the phone, and we talked about water quality, and we had some marvelous talks offline as they were getting up to speed about the work they're going to do for the camp. I would say that's our greatest challenge. We can find money. There's amazing money in NOAA and DEC programs and EPA programs for this kind of thing, but we have to be able to say to the next generation, this is yours. One of the most stunning things, and I shared this with April and Kira, that last year, Christmas week, the greatest Christmas present ever, a donor called me and he said, I'd like to talk to you about a floating classroom. I'm like, wait, like no one has talked to me about floating classrooms yet. It's actually becoming a thing across the nation. And the Finger Lakes Institute is doing a whole series of studies on this, all the floating classrooms. And basically, they're what Kara said. You get kids, instead of teaching them on land totally, you get them out on the water every day. And they get to be in kayaks and paddleboards and swim, and you pull the boat up to the beach, and they get to jump off and play in the water. Play is such an important part of this because it tells them this is yours.
Yeah.
You know, you can have fun. You can lay and just let the sun bake you, or you can swim or catch crayfish or And so this has set us on a course, something similar to Science on Seneca, the other SOS in the area. And by the way, the Science on Seneca group are remarkable, working with Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And they actually take teams of high school teachers, science teachers, out on the water for training day. And then all of those teachers come back and they go on the Scandling, which you guys both did, both April and Kira did. And then the teachers bring their classes and they go spend a day out on a research vessel, a real research vessel. I think it's 65 or 70 feet long. And you get to see microorganisms under microscopes that you just pulled out of the water. And you get to dig through mud. And Dr. Tara Curtin teaches, and she's another one of my heroes, teaches you what's in that mud. You're not just looking at a bucket of nothing. You're looking at something so remarkable that it would take your lifetime to understand it all. And so that's
beautifully said. And that is Don Reiling, the board president of Save Our SOTUS. We have to take a short break, but before we do, let me just read this email that we got from Mary in Rochester. Mary says, regarding nature-based learning, I read an article in the National Wildlife Federation recently about niños in nature from New Mexico. No need to rebuild the wheel from the beginning. Maybe we can learn from each other. That's a beautiful note to end on. We'll be right back after a very short break with Save Our SOTUS.
Coming up in the second hour of Environmental Connections, we're diving into the impact of climate change on wildlife. From mountain lions in California to farmed animals right here in New York, species are being pushed into unfamiliar territories, facing new dangers and challenges. Join us as we talk with local experts who are navigating these complex issues right in our area. That's all ahead in the second hour of Environmental Connections.
I'm Jasmine Singer, and you are listening to Environmental Connections. Today, we're talking about Save Our SOTUS, and one of my guests today is Kira Stevenson. Kira, we were just talking over the break about the Children's Bill of Rights, and I'm fascinated by this because oftentimes children feel so, you know, marginalized or maligned. So can you tell us a little bit about how they're not and what the Bill of Rights is?
Sure. So it's called the Children Outdoor Bill of Rights, otherwise known as the COBOR, if you hear people talking about it. And I'm on a vision team with Sarah Scott and Amanda Little, Chris Widmeyer from Rochester Ecology Partners, and Sheldon Cox from the RCSD as well. And the goal is to come up with an action plan to make sure that the 40,000, roughly, Rochester City youth have met the 12 rights, which are part of the Children Outdoor Bill of Rights. And there are things like learning about wildlife, learning to swim, learning to bike ride, connecting with nature,
playing the night outdoors. Snow,
yes, camping, seeing the stars.
Having access to a trail, I remember.
Right. Yeah. So all of these rights that were the rights that Rochester City youth deemed were the most important. And part of nature-based learning, obviously, is what can school districts do to help students and youth meet those rights. And then the community piece behind this. And this is where we're starting to see a lot of energy ramping up around nature-based learning and how I feel. It's one of the solutions to how do we do this on a larger scale and how do we connect communities. Rochester, we have the Rivery, which is a vessel on the Genesee River where students are able to do science and water quality testing and look at the geology of the river, learn the history of the river as well. And the issue is going to be how do we get all children access? You know, we're not just talking about pockets of children or pockets of neighborhood. This is when we're looking at solutions long term, and we're looking at, you know, the next generation of engineers and climate scientists and writers and artists that are going to be hopefully doing nature-based solutions in terms of helping communities along our Great Lakes. We need to get all children access, and that has to take a community. Our sixth graders at School 12 are going to be doing a project that is going to be kind of run by RIT, but it's also being supported by U of R when looking at the physical health and our it's around water quality and our plastics that are in our water. So the data part and the data collection is RIT, but then the health part is U of R. And there is so much, like Don, you were saying, there's funding. And now it's about how do we fund correctly and get the right community partners involved? Because we're not, if we don't do this, we don't have the next generation because they're only spending 9 minutes.
Yes.
Right?
And Dr. Luman, I'm seeing that you're vehemently nodding, and I want to know why. But let me just tell our listeners, if you also want to chime in on this discussion, please give us a call, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're local, 585-263-9994. Or you can email connections@wxxi.org and try and do it in the next few minutes if you can so that we have time to get to you. Dr. Luman, I know that you are very passionate about these subjects and about justice-centered education. So why the big reaction as Kira is talking about this?
I just think it's really important that kids get an opportunity to be their own agents of change, right? So we call it critical science agency in the literature, but the idea that you stand up for the bees, right? Or like the young man that Kira talked about, the seventh grader, I'm a bee hero, right? Or the kids who put signs up in their community saying, "Don't trash our pond," right? I think the play is really important, but the investment in making a difference and having that agency honored and recognized by the community, by family, it nurtures their identity. And that's what kids are doing, right, is becoming in this world. And so when they start to see themselves that way, right, the other thing I really wanted to underscore is this empathy and how important empathy is for climate change as well, right? So when you start thinking about climate change, it doesn't impact everybody equally, right? And it impacts the poor the most, right? It impacts the marginalized the most, right? So I have my teachers stand on a continuum of, is sea rise fair? And it sounds like a generic nature thing, right? Like, of course it's fair, it just happens, right? But then you start to weigh why sea rise, who's contributing to sea rise. Anyway, so like, I think the justice concerns are something that we need to engage all youth in as well.
I know that's something that you do with your educational programs. How do you do it? How do you incorporate issues of environmental justice into what you're teaching? And what's the reaction?
I think it's eye-opening for many. I think we live in our own little space. And so, and especially in our privileged spot of being by the Great Lakes, we're not experiencing climate change as intensely as many others. And so it is about nurturing empathy. And one way to do that is perspective taking. So invite learners, whether they're teacher learners or student learners, to take on the identity of a more than human other, for example, be a tree or be a bird or live in a tiny island near the equator, right? Like, perspective taking is hugely eye-opening.
Kira, continuing on that theme of equity, does nature-based learning help to level the playing field for students from different backgrounds?
100%. I would say not just backgrounds, but learning abilities yes.
Well-being.
And well-being and background. So, you know, we've seen it be a tool to help with a language barrier. We're at a bilingual school at School 12. I do not speak Spanish. I struggle greatly with learning another language. But when you are experiencing an organism doing its job, right? So it could be one of our classroom animals, or it could be watching the red-tailed hawk that nests near our school, and you're watching it hunt. You're sharing an experience and watching a relationship between things in an ecosystem, right? Organisms in an ecosystem. And you don't necessarily need verbal language. You know, you can see the excitement. You can see the wonder. and your, you know, body language changes, right? And then there can be a discussion or writing or drawings about what is occurring. I have seen so many students become empowered and passionate about things that you would never expect.
Like what?
Some of our eighth grade boys last year would probably, I mean, they would do anything to make sure that the plants were watered. And as a matter of fact, we just had an event at school last night, and we had a young man that has graduated from school 12 and is going to middle school. And he said, "Hi, miss," but very quickly, because the real question he wanted to get to was, "How are the plants?" And wanted to have that discussion around, like, how are the plants? Because this child made connections with just plants. And people are like, "Oh, it's just plants." No. There's something, you know, visceral that happens in our human body when you're digging in the dirt. And I will tell you this. I have a ton of gardening gloves. They don't get used as often as you think, because kids want to get their hands dirty.
Yeah, sure.
And dirt is okay.
Yeah, make friends with the wormies.
That's right.
Dr. Luman, what do you see as the future of environmental education, particularly in rural areas like SOTUS?
My hope, it's my hopeful future, is that school walls come tumbling down, where youth and families and communities and Don Reilings of the world are all in partnership together, and we learn together with our more than human other, you know, neighbors, right? Like, that is my hope, that classrooms understand and embrace the fact that we cannot do this alone. Like, climate change, citizen education, in the literature, they call these things wicked problems, right? They require all of us. They require creativity. They require agency. And if we're preparing kids for the planet's future, their future, they need to have opportunities to dig deep, to dig transdisciplinarily, to dig multi-generationally. They need to be able to engage with change groups from around the world. Like, we are not just in classrooms anymore.
And backing that up is an email from Charlie. Charlie says, 30 years ago, I was a rookie teacher at Charlotte Middle School, and we had a fire drill, and I looked down Lake Avenue, and I remarked, "Look, there's white caps on Lake Ontario." A few kids looked at me with puzzled looks, and one said, "What lake?" I quickly realized I had work to do. And I got the maps out and explained the Great Lakes. And a few days later, we took a walk down to the lake. The kids took off their shoes, just ran wild on the beach. And we made that a bit of a routine after that. The power of water and nature.
Wow.
And thank you, Charlie. Making Kira's point also about how they want to get dirty. They want to feel the dirt in their hands and the sand on their feet. You're tearing up.
I do, because it's... It's a personal passion. And I think when you get to see exactly what Charlie experienced, it's life changing. And when it's life changing for one and two and multiple and 800 students at one school, it's life changing for a community and our planet. And this is being done. You know, the walls are coming down. This is the City of Rochester School District, and this is going to other schools. So when people say this can't be done, they're wrong. And the people that I talk to, I mean, I just had a teacher from Virginia email me yesterday. You know, the City of Rochester School District is supporting this, and it's incredible because it's going to change the community. You know, and when you see the kids connect, just like Charlie experienced, you know, and Charlie, if you want to come help out at Nature Based Learning at School 12, you can shoot me an email. You're welcome anytime. You know, this is what makes me hopeful, and hope is an action word, right? And it doesn't matter if you're in the City of Rochester or you're in SOTUS, kids are kids, and this is what is going to have the biggest impact.
That's beautiful.
You know, can I jump in there, Jasmine?
Please.
The going back to the floating classroom, the sponsor who called me, he said, "The only way I'll give this money is if you guarantee me the kids will get on the water who would never have had access. And I said to him, well, you know, there's the beach. He said, Don, it's not the bay. He said, if you don't have a boat and if you don't have a cottage, you can't experience this amazing bay. And I said, and he said, my family, speaking for him, my family grew up there for four generations. And he said, we've the wealth, all the blessings of our life have come largely because of this region and the bay. But he said, there are just too many people who wouldn't have a chance to experience it. Will you promise me?
Yeah.
And that inspires me so much to say, yeah, we've got to make this happen.
Don, I have a question because you have a diverse background from international relief work to executive coaching. I'm curious how you bring those experiences into your leadership at Save Our Sodas.
I think the one that inspires me the most are some of the young leaders who are popping up. We've got an amazing board, Jasmine. I'm so delighted to work with them. Our meetings are just inspiring. And not many people say that about board meetings.
It's true. Right?
Overall. But the gang that makes me want to get out of bed in the morning are these two guys, Leo Halligan and Billy Kedley, who are both environmental science students who both grew up on the bay. And they were actually, I met them because they were instructors at the junior sailing program. And they're both now studying environmental science because they love the water, because the bay changed their life, because they want to make sure it's protected. And they're excited about SOS because they want to make sure that a whole nother generation of the kids who are only a couple years behind them get to experience what we're talking about. So that's where I bring leadership into it. I used to mobilize or recruit. I would have to go to people who had never been out of the United States and say, would you help us with a medical team in Honduras? Mm. And they would say, well, why? Why is it important? And the big why is that's the one, right? That's the big question. Simon Sinek calls it the golden circle. And the why in that case was, well, because people in the mountains have never had medical care ever. And so we would take 10 medical teams, fly them up into all the different corners. The young people coming back out of that high school and college age, they were changed forever. Their parents would write me letters and say, what did you do with my child? The one who came back is not the same one we sent. And I just have the same kind of hope. We can use those same tools to recruit workers, kids, create opportunities. We're hoping to do an environmental camp next summer on the water.
Oh, that'd be great. And
we've got access to streams and boats, and we're all working together quietly on this. You know, we're sort of dreaming and scheming.
Can radio hosts in their mid-40s come?
For sure.
We would so
asking
love
for
adult
Evan.
Camp.
I'm asking for Evan.
Yeah, we would so love to have you guys come and mud, you know, dig through the mud with us. There's something called the D-net. And a D-net, you put it down on the bottom of the stream. Somebody upstream stirs up the bottom. Stuff comes into it. Hmm. So how do kids use a D-net? They've got to be up to their knees or their waist in the water.
Hip sure. waders are the best.
And so then they lift up and they put it on a table. And for the first time in their life, they're seeing things they've never seen. You want to talk about awe and wonder. You see it in their eyes. I mean, we all go home so inspired we can't sleep that night. So we'd love to have you guys.
I love it. We have an email from a listener who didn't mention their name. The listener says, bioanthropologist Peter Warshall, the longtime editor of Whole Earth, asked people to know their watershed first and developed a Know Your Watershed quiz for Co-Evolution Quarterly. Every person should know where their water comes from and where it goes when you flush the toilet. Warshall also encouraged people to find your animal ally. That's nice.
I love cool. that.
Yeah.
That's what we say to teachers. You have to learn all of that stuff and then keep it to yourself, right? Because students need to learn it for themselves, right? But you could be their guides around that.
As we start to close, and I do want to say that I've never in any of the shows I've hosted had a panel more supportive of each other than the three of you. You're literally snapping and nodding and clapping. And it's beautiful to see how this is also bringing all of you together. I'm curious, Don, briefly, can you mention any upcoming initiatives for Save Our Sodas, anything to keep an eye on?
A week from tomorrow, we're going to take young families and some Boy Scouts and Anyone who wants to join us, and we're going to take boats. There's a couple of corners of the bay that have collected garbage because the way the wind blows, you know, it gets captured. And we're going to pull invasive weeds, and we're going to pick up garbage. That's next. Through the fall months, we're putting together some lecture series because there's some amazing people like Dr. Sammy Romanek, who's at University of Rochester. Go you are. And she is doing microbiology studies on how microplastics are affecting our health. And so we're all working together to say, how do we get this out to the communities? So those are two coming up
soon. Wonderful. And Kira, turning to you, any future initiatives in nature-based learning that you're most excited about very briefly?
The kids coming back on Thursday. Yeah. I know the first thing a lot of them are going to ask are, how are Stiggy and Petunia? Those are our tortoises, and Wiggles, our snake that is in the classroom,
yeah.
which we now have a nature center. It's not a classroom. It's called the North Star Nature Center after the paper that Frederick Douglass was the author of, because we're on the Frederick Douglass campus. And kicking off the first full week of school with nature-based learning with scavenger hunts so that all students and all teachers at School 12 know where they will be learning.
Beautiful. And just as we start to close, 10 seconds or less, Dr. Luman, what are you excited about?
I'm excited about partnering with the people at this table.
Yes.
And connecting Kira's work with RCSD chemistry teacher Gavin Jenkins to do this work in chemistry, high school chemistry.
Thank you all so much, Don Reiling, Dr. April Luman, and Kira Stevenson. I'm Jasmine Singer, and if you're listening to this, big thanks to you for making today's Environmental Connections.